determined that the Klan, specifically the Orlando Clavern, was behind the bombing. But as the investigation narrowed its focus, the Klansmen closed rank. At their meetings, they now began requiring everyone to recite the Klan Oath of Secrecy as the investigation closed in on them. The chief suspects all said they had been at a barbecue with 20 or 30 other members at the time of the attack, a convenient alibi for most anyone who would come under suspicion. Ultimately, no one was ever charged or spent a day in jail for the murder of Harry and Harriet Moore, considered by some the first casualties of the modern civil rights movement. News of the bombing reached George up in Harlem, and he found it both shocking and half expected, knowing what he did about that land of raccoon woods and cypress swamps, thick with fear and secrets. When he spoke of Harry T. Moore, he spoke matter-of-factly, without emotion, flat and to the point. It was as if nothing in the world could surprise him. He had just about heard and seen it all. Years later, when George was an old man, he would find God, become a deacon, and join the choir at a Baptist church in Harlem. People always said he had a beautiful voice. He was a tenor baritone. He knew all the words to just about any Baptist hymn. Whenever he stood up and sang, there he was, towering over all the sopranos and tenors, his voice rising up above the others, but his eyes welling up and tears falling in droplets down the sides of his cheeks. It happened whenever he sang. Los Angeles, mid to late 1950s. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. Robert was making a bigger name for himself now. He was getting a reputation not just for making a show of his every arrival, but for being the kind of doctor who could just look at somebody and tell that the problem was with the spleen. The people from Monroe began taking notice. They started coming around, tentative and curious at first. Robert never knew what to expect when they showed up. Jimmy Marshall's mother had tried to make herself go and see Robert, but for the longest time she just couldn't get used to his being a doctor. She still hadn't adjusted to the idea of calling him Robert. She kept slipping and couldn't bring herself to say it. "I can't believe Lou Pershing Foster is a doctor," she once exclaimed. He was becoming so popular that she finally went to see him. But she was appalled at what he asked of her at her first appointment. "How dare you tell me to take my clothes off?" she told Robert as he prepared for the examination. "Bob got so tickled," Jimmy remembered. "Then, after he treated her, she had to admit, he's a good little doctor." Robert's office was well situated on West Jefferson, a fashionable black business district closer to Beverly Hills than South Central, and he now had admitting privileges at several hospitals. He was getting to know other doctors, but oddly enough, and just as important, was popular with the orderlies and charge nurses, and even the people in the cafeteria, the kind of people other doctors ignored. And they started showing up at his office, too. "My patients loved me," he said matter-of-factly years later. "They could tell me anything. They'd tell you in a minute I can talk to you." They waited for hours to see him. Many were people who back in Texas or Louisiana or Arkansas might have only rarely seen a physician, who were used to midwives and root doctors and home remedies they handed down and concocted for themselves. Here was a doctor who was as science-minded and proficient as any other, but who didn't make fun of their down-home superstitions and knew how to comfort them and translate modern medicine into a language they could understand. It was 20 people deep on Saturdays, Melissa Briley, a patient of his, remembered. They would come early, sign up, then leave, go shopping and run errands, come back 3 or 4 hours later and still have to wait. Any number of times he'd ask, "How long you been waiting?" "Don't even ask me," she'd say. "You know how long I been waiting." People would complain among themselves. They would sit up in the office and fuss and carry on about how he's never on time, Briley said, and the very next time you go, you see the same people waiting. And after hours of sitting and passing the time, when they finally made it into his office, he would light a cigarette and throw his feet up on his desk and ask them what was going on in their lives. "Tell me about it," he would say. Husbands shared suspicions about their wives. Mothers brought their children in. "Doctor, I believe she's pregnant," a mother told Robert. "Make her tell you whose baby it is." He loved it so much, he practically gave his life over to the worries and fixes his patients got themselves into. "If you got sick and had a complication," he said, "I didn't leave your bed until you showed signs of improvement, if it took all night long. If you had tubes down your nose and through your stomach and intravenous going, I'd stay there and be sure that they worked. Then I'd get up and go home, shave, dress, get as sharp as I could get, and come back at visiting hours, and walk over to the bed, feel the pulse. 'Miss Brown, you feel any better?' he'd say. 'Baby, this is my doctor,' the patient would tell her husband. Sometimes the discussion was with the relative in the room. 'Hey, Doc, he's sick as he can be,' a patient's relative might say. It got to the point that it seemed people could tell when he stepped out of the elevator and onto the floor, and it reassured people, and they almost started feeling better at the sight of him. This spread to the friends and relatives visiting the patient, and to the people who weren't his patients, seeing him dote on someone else. "You know some other doctor's patient," he said, "and they call me in to do the surgery, or whatever it was, and then I wouldn't go back until the man is better. When I know he looks better, and I'm sharp, got on the latest fashions, I put the show on so you wouldn't forget. They call me the Jitterbug Doctor. Think I'm kidding, don't you? Straight, straight just like it is. But the point was that they would not forget me, and others would see you in the room with them, and they would remember you outside the room. They'd get your card and call you." Sometimes he'd hear from patients' relatives, people coming in from out of town or just new to California who were feeling under the weather and worried what it might be. Someone would hand them Robert's number with no more explanation than this: "If you just call this number and tell him I'm sick, he'll tell you what to do." One of the people who called him one day was a cook from East Texas working the cafeteria line at the old hospital on Hoover Street. She had seen the Jitterbug Doctor, liked him, and told him she had a cousin she thought could use his help. The cook sent her cousin to see Robert for a physical and an assessment of her medical problems. The cook's cousin was a woman named Della Beatrice Robinson. People called her Della B. She was a singer who had not long since migrated from Texas. Della B took her cousin's suggestion and made an appointment. Della B was so pleased with the treatment and with the southern down-home way about this doctor, something comforting and familiar about him, that she kept coming back. She also had another idea. "My husband needs to come in to see you," she said after a few visits. She said her husband would need the last appointment of the day, and that his name was Ray Charles Robinson. Ray Charles, to most of the world. "So there I got Ray Charles," Robert would say years later. "The rest was up to me and Ray, and it flew." Both men were from the South and had come to Los Angeles chasing a dream, Ray having migrated in 1950, 3 years before Robert. Both were more ambitious, controlling, and meticulous than the gaudy juke joint side of them might suggest. Both moved in highfalutin circles, but were most at ease with plain-spoken common folk, which is what they really were deep inside. They were both on the verge of making it big in their respective worlds, and neither could truly put behind them the hurts each had endured in the South, or overcome the excesses of those fixations. The two would be friends from that day on. With all these new patients, Robert's practice was taking off. He was now ready to move his family into a house more befitting their station. From his in-laws' perspective, it was about time. The Clements were living in the president's mansion, pretty much an estate back at Atlanta University, and they felt their daughter and granddaughters had been holed up long enough in that walk-up apartment off Jefferson. It was enough that Robert had taken the three of them away from Atlanta and the Clements, as it was. When was he ever going to make good on his potential, all his talk, and give Alice and the girls the luxuries to which the Clements had made them accustomed? It had been 18 months already. Robert found a way out. He located a house on an exclusive block of Georgians and avant-garde contemporaries, with putting green lawns and bougainvillea draping the sides of vanilla stucco walls. The block was in a neighborhood known as West Adams, just south of Pico, a few minutes' drive from Wilshire, and on the western side of Crenshaw. It already had a few colored people living there. The fights over restrictive covenants had occurred a decade before, so he wouldn't have to make a political statement just to move into a house, which, apolitical as he was, would not have interested him. He chose not to try to integrate a new neighborhood, although by then he could have afforded most any he wanted. Two court rulings, Shelley v. and Barrows v., had struck down restrictive covenants by the time he arrived, but whites were still resisting black incursions into the strongholds of Glendale, Canoga Park, Hawthorne, Southgate, and through most of the San Fernando Valley. There was a bombing near Culver City and cross-burning in Leimert Park. Some neighborhood groups went so far as to buy up properties themselves, even at a financial loss, to prevent blacks from moving in, wrote the historian Josh Sides. But the San Fernando Valley suburb of Pacoima got especially creative when a black government worker named Emery Holmes moved in with his family in 1959. The neighbors put their heads together and decided to make calls to every business in town, posing as Holmes or his wife. The first week in the neighborhood, the Holmeses were flooded at odd times of the day with visits from a life insurance sales representative, a milk delivery service, a drinking water company, three repair services, several taxis, an undertaker, a Los Angeles Times newspaper carrier, a veterinarian, a sink repair service, a termite exterminator, a pool installer, Sides wrote. Finally, the neighbors threw rocks through their windows and spray-painted their garage, "Black cancer is here. Don't let it spread." Robert wasn't going to put himself through that. He found a safe place that suited him. Not only were black people there already, but they were among the finest and most socially connected in all of old Los Angeles. The house was a white Spanish revival at 1680 Victoria Avenue, right next door to the most prominent colored architect in Los Angeles, and maybe the country, Paul Williams. The street had physicians and dentists and socialites on it, people who regularly made the society pages of the Los Angeles Sentinel. The family moved in on Palm Sunday, 1956, 3 years after Robert's lonely drive through the desert. The girls each chose a room. The sofas and cocktail tables and dining room suite arrived. Now Alice could finally join the Lynx and host her bridge parties and socials, and they could all take up their rightful place, wherever it might lead them, in this bright new city of theirs. In the meantime, shortly before moving into their new home, Robert and Alice got a welcome surprise. A third daughter arrived in December 1955. They named her Joy. Complications. "What on earth was it," I mused, bending my head to the wind, "that made us leave the warm, mild weather of home for all this cold, and never to return, if not for something worth hoping for?" Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man. Chicago, 1939 to 1940. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Things had grown desperate, and although she had three little ones at home, Ida Mae had to find some kind of work if they were to survive another year. The options for colored women fresh from the field were limited up north, mainly to cleaning white people's homes, doing laundry, or working a factory line, if the factory was short of men or of white women. For Ida Mae, domestic work was the likeliest option for now. It was still the Depression, and it seemed as if the North just didn't know what to do with colored women who were still learning the ways of the cities. Even in the best of times, many industries, while accepting black men for their strong backs, and then only in limited numbers, refused to hire black women, seeing no need to have them around. Throughout the North and West, black women migrants were having the hardest time finding work of all the people pouring into the big cities, harder than Polish and Serbian immigrants to Chicago, harder than Italian and Jewish immigrants to New York, harder than Mexican and Chinese immigrants of either gender in California. They were literally at the bottom of the economic hierarchy of the urban North, the least connected by race and gender to the power brokers in their adopted lands, and having to stand in line to hire out scrubbing floors when times got hard during the Depression years. Some employers started requiring them to have college degrees, which neither they nor the vast majority of other unskilled laborers could have been expected to have. Some demanded that black women take voice tests to weed out those from the South, tests that Mississippians just up from the plantation would have been all but assured of failing. Even those lucky enough to land in a training course for assembly line work found that they were often shunted to positions in either the cafeteria or bathrooms. Entire companies and classes of work were closed off to them without apology. A few years after Ida Mae arrived, a plant in Ohio, for instance, sent out a call for 500 women, specifying that they be white. The plant had to alter its age limits, lower its requirements, and go to neighboring states like Illinois to get enough white women, who were more likely than colored women, to be able to stay at home with their children. Even when it was unable to fill its quota, the plant still refused to hire colored women. Thus, colored women were left to fight for even the most menial of jobs, facing intense competition from the Irish, German, and Scandinavian servant girls preferred by some of the wealthier white families. There emerged several classes of domestics. Those on the lowest rung resorted to slave markets, where colored women gathered on street corners from as early as 6 a.m. and waited for white housewives from the Bronx and Brooklyn in New York, or from Hyde Park or Pill Hill in Chicago, to bid on them for as little as 15 cents an hour. 25 such markets were active in New York City alone by 1940. One was by a five-and-dime at 167th Street in Girard, near the Grand Concourse in the Bronx, where the lowliest women from Harlem sat on crates, waiting to be picked. Another was a few blocks north at 170th and Walton, the waiting women a little better clothed and slightly less desperate, knowing that the Bronx housewives had to pass them first before getting to the market at Girard. In Chicago, there was a crowded market at 12th and Halsted, where colored women jockeyed over the white housewives who were looking them over, the whole enterprise having the effect of bidding down the colored domestics' wages. One woman at the Chicago slave market reported making 50 cents a day, what she would have made picking cotton in the field. If she were desperate enough, a colored woman needing work would just show up in a white neighborhood, the wealthier the better, and simply walk down the street. Someone would invariably call out the window, wrote the sociologist Barbara Clegg Gray, and hire the woman on the spot to clean the toilets or scrub the floors, or whatever the white housewife discovered she needed for maybe a dollar or two. In Los Angeles, due to the great horde of jobless domestics, white families in one of the wealthiest cities in the country could hire colored domestics for as little as $5 a week in the 1930s. For that sum, families got someone who would work 10 or 12 hours a day, doing anything from washing dishes and clothes to cooking and scrubbing floors, for not much more than she could have made picking cotton back in Texas. One colored woman in Los Angeles said she thought getting her high school diploma would make a difference. She kept trying to find different work. Jobs on assembly lines, running elevators, clerking in stores, filing in offices were typical jobs open to unskilled women in those days. But everywhere I went, she said, they wanted to keep me working as a domestic. The randomness of this kind of work, hiring oneself out to total strangers with no standards in duties or wages, opened domestics to all kinds of exploitation for very little pay. They could never know for sure what they would be asked to do, how long they would be expected to do it, or if they would be paid what was promised. It seemed everyone was trying to wring the most out of whatever they had, some white housewives even turning back the hands of the clock to keep from paying a domestic for all the hours she actually worked. Older domestics took to forewarning the new ones to take their own clock to work with them and to prepare for any indignity. One housewife ordered a domestic to eat her lunch out of the pet's bowl, not wanting the help to eat from the same dishes as the family. In many cases, the housewives were neither accustomed to hired help nor familiar with colored people, harboring assumptions and prejudices of the day due to lack of exposure. The housewives and their domestics brought differing expectations, and frequently each side felt somehow aggrieved. While an employer could go out and hire someone else, some employees, having no legal recourse, took their frustrations out on their madams' homes when not paid or otherwise exploited, slashing the draperies they had just ironed or defacing the floors they had scrubbed. Aside from these sources of friction, colored domestics could not know what perils they might face from opportunistic sons or husbands, assuming that younger domestics would do more than just clean. As it was, the very act of walking the streets from work came awfully close in appearance to how prostitutes plied their trade, except that the domestics were working at the whim of Janes instead of Johns. The expectation that any colored woman walking in the white section of town was available to scrub floors and wash windows would continue into the 1960s, such that a colored professional woman appearing in a white neighborhood in the North had to be prepared to be called out to just because she was black. "Say, girl," a woman called out to my mother in the late 1950s when she was on her way in her tailored suit and heels to decorate and fit slipcovers in Cleveland Park, a wealthy neighborhood in Washington, D.C. "Could you come up here and clean my bathroom?" "I'm looking for someone to clean mine," my mother yelled back to the woman. Ida Mae's husband would not have stood for his wife to walk the streets for work, and in any case, Chicago had grown so segregated that the wealthy white neighborhoods were far from where they lived. But one day Ida Mae got word of a job from someone she knew from back home in Mississippi, and that felt a little safer. A girl who was doing day's work for a well-to-do couple on the north side needed someone to fill in for her. It would be temporary, Ida Mae's friend told her, but would have to do for now. "Miss Gladney will work in your place," Ida Mae's friend told the girl. The job was more than an hour away on the streetcar, farther north of the loop than she lived south, almost up near Evanston. The regular girl who mopped floors and folded laundry for the family would be away for a week. The job was paying something like $4 or $5 a day. Ida Mae didn't hesitate. "I was glad to take her place," she would say years later. She dressed for the job and took a change of clothes with her. It turned out to be a man and his wife living in a grand apartment above a shoe store the wife ran. Ida Mae took the elevator up and went into a glorious apartment, where she found the husband alone in the couple's bedroom. He was still asleep, which seemed odd to Ida Mae, so she began looking for things to do. The husband roused himself and told Ida Mae what he expected of her. "Get in the bed with me," he said. He told her the regular girl stayed in bed with him all day long. He reassured Ida Mae not to worry. He'd do the cleaning later. He figured that was a fair exchange and good deal for her, a cleaning girl not having to clean at all and still getting paid for it. Ida Mae was in her mid-twenties, a mother of three by then, married to a pious man who wouldn't stand for another man touching his wife. She knew white men in the South took whatever liberties they wanted with colored women, and there was nothing the women or their husbands could do about it. All her life in Mississippi, she had managed to avoid unwanted advances because she had rarely worked in white people's homes. Now here she was in Chicago, a white man expecting her to sleep with him, as if that were what any colored woman would just naturally want to do. And no matter what happened, she would have no legal recourse. There would be no witnesses. It just would be a privileged man's word against hers. She was thinking fast. She was as mad at the girl who sent her without warning her of what the job really entailed, as she was at the man expecting her to climb into bed with him, with his wife just a floor below. She started to leave, but she'd come all this way, had spent the train fare, and she needed the money. Her body stiffened, and she backed away from the man. "Just show me what you want cleaned," Ida May said. Somehow, something in the way she stood or looked straight at him as she said it let the man know she meant business. He didn't press the matter. He left her alone. "He didn't say no more, 'cause he seen I wasn't that type of person," Ida May said years later. And perhaps in that moment, Ida May discovered one difference between the North and South. She would not likely have gotten out of it in Mississippi. Her refusal would have been seen as impudence, all but assuring an assault. And there would have been nothing done about it. Here, the Northern man seemed to view such a conquest as a hoped-for fringe benefit, rather than a right. That, along with Ida May's indignation over the whole thing, appeared to keep her safe. That day, she cleaned the bathroom, the kitchen, the bedroom, and changed the linens, as she had gone there to do. The man stayed in his room. She never went back. She missed out on the rest of the week's pay, which she desperately needed. Later, she confronted the regular girl who worked for the couple. "So you don't do nothing but stay in the bed all day, huh?" Ida May said. "Don't ask me to go back up there again." The girl paid Ida May out of the money she was making off the couple. The whole sordid affair stayed with Ida May for years. She couldn't see how the girl could live with herself. "I just don't know," Ida May would say years later. "Supposing the wife came back home, I just couldn't see how she did it." With five mouths to feed, the family couldn't go much longer unless Ida May found a job. In the fall of 1939, something finally opened up at Inland Steel over at 63rd and Melvina, on the city's southwest side. George had a brother working there. At this point, Ida May didn't much care what it was as long as it wasn't day's work cleaning toilets and fighting off the madam's husband. It was her first real job in Chicago. They called her a press operator. She was in the canning department, where her job was to work the presser that attached the curved tops that cover cans as they came down the assembly line. She had to fit the tops on, her arms going up and down and up and down, over and over and over again. She was excited at first, but then found it to be a nerve-jangling endeavor. The factory was loud, the noise a little like being inside a car engine. The mechanical arms that she operated were sharp and heavy, and were known to slice off people's fingers and hands. She was on the line one day when another worker, a colored woman, got some of her fingers cut off. Ida May was a couple of machines down from her. There wasn't much of a commotion, as Ida May remembered it. "They stopped everybody for a while," she said. "Then they went out with her so fast, and she never did come back." Ida May quit soon after that. A line job turned up at Campbell's Soup, where George was working. It wouldn't last long, either, after a woman stole her coat that winter. She got a job at a printing press, and it looked to be a good one. But in time, she would get a job at a hospital, Walther Memorial, on the west side of Chicago, working as a hospital aide. She sterilized instruments, cheered up patients, which was her specialty, and organized the gauzes, bandages, and intravenous lines in central supply. It took her a while to learn how everything worked and how to get the little scissors and scalpels cleaned just so. "I washed tray by tray and put the instruments back in there till I learned it," Ida May said. "And I learned all them instruments. Some of them I couldn't call the name, but you better believe I know where they went." Sometimes she would poke her head in during surgery when she dropped off a tray of instruments she had sterilized. She liked to see the babies come into the world, and the doctors let her stay sometimes. She had been through it four times herself, and still marveled at the sight and sound of a new life making its entrance. "They always come out hollering," she said, just like her babies had. You know, that's amazing, ain't it? She said. With Ida Mae working, the family could move out of the one-room apartment at 21st and State and into a flat big enough for everyone. In the coming years, they would live all over the Black Belt. Now that they were getting situated, people from back home in Mississippi started to make their way north to stay or to visit and see what it was like. Saint, who had helped them move their things from Ed Pearson's plantation and get out of Mississippi, came up with his wife Catherine and their children and stayed for good. Ida Mae's brother-in-law Aubrey, her younger sister Talma's husband, came up for a while to see if he would like it, but he didn't, and moved back to Mississippi, where the people tipped their hat to you as they passed, and looked up to him because of his family's long years in the South, where he had made peace and found a way to get along with the white people and benefit from it. Joe Lee, whose flogging was the reason George and Ida Mae had left, even came up and lived there for a while. But he was never quite right after all he had been through. He never married, and did not make out very well, or live too long, and nobody cared to talk about him very much. One time, George's brother Winston, whom everyone called Win, came up from the plantation just for a visit, and wasn't ashamed to look up at the tall buildings reaching for the sky. George took him around the first day, and at the end of it, they settled in for the night. Win got ready for bed and then started calling for his brother. "Come help me," Win said. "I can't blow this light out." George found him standing by the bulb. Win had been blowing on the bulb until he was almost out of breath. "Win, you can't blow it out. You gotta turn it off," George told him, reaching for the light switch and shaking his head. It hadn't been that long ago that he, too, had been callow to the new world. "George showed him how to cut it off," Ida Mae said, "and we never had no more trouble with him." They were becoming Chicagoans now. They would talk about Win and that light bulb for years. It was only a matter of time before just about every colored family in the North, unsettled though they might have been, got visitors, as George and Ida Mae did. There was a back and forth of people, anxious, giddy, wanting to come north and see what all the fuss was about. And whenever a colored guest paid a visit while the migration was on, and even decades later, he or she could be assured of finding the same southern peasant food, the same turnip greens, ham hocks, cornbread, in Chicago, as in Mississippi. But the visitors were a curiosity to the children of the North. The uncles and cousins from the South often had a slow-talking, sweetly alien, wide openness about them that could both enchant and startle some of the more reserved nieces and nephews who barely knew them, as was the case with a character from Mississippi visiting relatives in Pittsburgh in August Wilson's The Piano Lesson in the following exchange. "Boy Willie. How you doing, sugar?" "Maritha. Fine." "Boy Willie. You was just a little old thing last time I seen you. You remember me, don't you? This your Uncle Boy Willie from down south. That there's Lyman. He my friend. We come up here to sell watermelons. You like watermelons?" Maritha nods. "We got a whole truckload out front. You can have as many as you want." "What you been doing?" Maritha.
"Nothing."
Boy Willie.
"Don't be shy now. Look at you getting all big. How old is you?"
Maritha.
11. I'm gonna be 12 soon."
Boy Willie.
"You like it up here? You like the North?"
Maritha.
"It's all right."
Boy Willie.
"That there's Lyman. Did you say hi to Lyman?"
Maritha.
"Hi."
Lyman.
"How you doing? You look just like your mama. I remember you when you was wearing diapers."
Boy Willie.
"You gonna come down south and see me? Uncle Boy Willie gonna get him a farm. Gonna get a great big old farm. Come down there and I'll teach you how to ride a mule. Teach you how to kill a chicken, too."
New York, 1950s, George Swanson Starling. George was just back one evening from a 48-hour turnaround from New York to Florida and to New York again, and had gotten his check and cashed it. Rather than head straight home to Inez, he thought he'd stop and get a drink at a bar near Penn Station. He was with another colored railroad attendant, chugging his beer as the bar filled up. He and his co-worker barely noticed that everyone else at the bar happened to be white, as they regaled each other with stories from riding the rails. When it was time to go, they paid their tab and put their glasses down. The bartender had said very little to them the whole time they were there. Now the bartender calmly picked up their glasses, and instead of loading them into a tray to be washed, he took them and smashed them under the counter. The sound of glass breaking on concrete startled George and his co-worker, even though this wasn't the first time this had happened to them, just not at this bar, and it attracted the attention of other patrons. "They do it right in front of us," George said. "That's the way they let us know they didn't want us in there. As fast as you drink out of a glass and set it down, they break it." There were no colored or white signs in New York. That was the unnerving and tricky part of making your way through a place that looked free. You never knew when perfect strangers would remind you that, as far as they were concerned, you weren't equal and might never be. It was just the prerogative of whoever happened to be in a position to keep you from getting what the law said you had a right to, because nobody was going to enforce it anyway. And so the glass he drank from went crashing under a counter in Manhattan. It was hitting George in all directions. At sudden and unexpected times like these in New York, in crude and predictable ways when he went back south for his job, and now on the train itself, he was a stickler for rules and regulations and business-like comportment, even if it was only for lifting and loading bags. He was in uniform and was representing not just the railroad, but himself and colored people, and he took the job of attending to his passengers seriously. His formal bearing did not sit well with some of the southern conductors he worked for, who considered him acting above his station, which, to his mind, he was. He still saw himself as the college boy, someone who read the newspapers, kept up with world affairs, and knew as much as most anyone he was serving. The white southerners he worked with didn't like it any more than the Grove foreman did. "They kept me at a hardship," George said. Somehow, without trying, he managed to get on the bad side of a southern conductor out of Tampa. The conductor liked to tease and joke with the colored attendants, one in particular. The conductor would nudge and kick the colored attendant, and the colored attendant, knowing his place, would jump and laugh, and to George's mind, put on a show for the conductor. "Ha-ha, don't do that, Cap," the colored attendant would josh the conductor in mock protest. George stood stone-faced and made no attempt to hide his disdain. Now the conductor began making extra demands on them all. He liked to make the rail attendants wipe the rail car steps while the train was moving. He got a kick out of that. He wanted the attendants to drop the traps of the bottom step and wipe the steps down so he wouldn't get dirt on him when he got off to direct passengers at the station. Usually it was something the attendants did once the train had stopped. The conductor didn't want that. He liked to see them bending over, dangling along the side and struggling to wipe the bottom step while the train was running 25, 30 miles an hour. George resisted wiping the steps until he thought it was safe. The other car attendant did as the conductor ordered. George stood to the side, his face pinched and frowning, as his co-worker tried to hold on and clean the step, with the train rocking toward the station and the conductor chortling at the sight of it. One day the conductor confronted George.
"What's the matter with you, boy? You can't laugh?" "Yes, sir, I have a good sense of humor," George said. "But I don't see anything funny about what y'all are doing."
The conductor began singling out George from that day on, blocking him in the aisles, jabbing him as he passed. There was little George could do about it and still keep his job. George had been through worse things in the South and figured it was just one more thing he would have to watch out for. But it got to the point that when George saw him coming down the aisle to check tickets, he had to step between the seats to avoid a confrontation.
"He got to the place when he'd get along about where I was," George said, "and he would step out of the aisle in between the seats and step on my foot like that. And then he'll walk back and look at me."
George thought to himself, "I don't know how I'ma deal with this, 'cause he gonna do this one day, and I'ma try to kill him."
"I was praying that I never had to reach that point," he said.
One afternoon, they were pulling out of Clearwater on the Silver Star, a sleek, steel-encased all-reserve train that was the pride of the Seaboard Airline Railroad. It went up the west coast of Florida along the Gulf of Mexico en route to New York. It had only the finest and highest class people on it, as George remembered, and he had worked his way up to that route. As the train gained speed as it headed out of the station, George was helping an elderly white lady with her two bags. He had gotten one bag into the rack overhead and was heaving the second bag over the edge of the compartment.
"And just as I went up with the next bag and set it up in the rack," George said, "something hit me from behind like a truck. Boom!"
The conductor, a sturdy and heavy-set man, had knocked into George as George tried to steady himself on the moving train while holding the bag overhead. George's knees were bad from all the basketball he had played in high school, and standing on the train rocking as it was, he was off balance and had nothing to hold on to.
"He come up from behind me like a football player blocking the line," George said.
The conductor shoved George into the seat where the passenger was. George managed to drop the bag onto the rack and not onto the elderly white passenger, but the force of the conductor's weight knocked George over onto the lady, a precarious situation for a colored man in the South. The train rumbled from side to side as George stood and tried to straighten himself. He suspected he knew what had happened, but looked around anyway and saw the conductor in the aisle, grinning. This feud was escalating to a point that was getting dangerous for George. If the passenger were hurt or frightened by a colored man sprawled over her as he was, George would be the one to take the fall for it, and the conductor knew it. If the passenger grew hysterical and accused George of attacking her, there would be nothing George could do, and far worse could happen to him. But it was a fortunate thing for George that the white woman saw that he had been pushed and did not let it rattle her.
"Well, what's wrong with him?" she asked George.
"Miss, you know what he was trying to do?"
She shook her head, "No."
"He was trying to make me drop that bag on your head. He's just that mean, and he just don't like nobody. He did that to try to make me drop that bag on your head."
"What is wrong with him?"
George started telling his story about how the conductor had been harassing him all this time, and now the conductor had pushed him and didn't even seem to care about the passenger's safety, and she listened because she had seen it for herself.
"Well, something needs to be done about that."
"Yes, ma'am, but they just don't pay me no attention if I try to do anything about it."
He paused.
"But you could do something about it."
"Well, who do I write?"
"You just write it and I'll send it," he said, not wanting to risk her forgetting about it or just not getting around to it. "You write it and give it to me."
And so the woman wrote up her complaint and gave the letter to George. He, in turn, attached a letter of his own and sent it to the superintendent in Jacksonville, Florida, who was over that route at that time. George never heard from the superintendent's office about the harassment he had endured.
"But when they saw her letter, they immediately went into action," he said.
The office called the conductor in to question him about the white woman's complaint and suspended him for 60 days. It wasn't long before the conductor found out that it was George who had had a hand in the suspension, and of course, that did not sit well with him. George only heard the outcome from other attendants and never got a response himself. Still, it could be said that he had emerged victorious, and that only created more trouble for him. He had expected as much and had prepared for it. When he dropped off the woman's letter, he decided to do it on the way north, so that by the time it got into the superintendent's hands, George would be well out of Florida and out of the conductor's orbit. Back in New York, he went straight to the railroad office to get a route change.
"Look, I'm not going back to the West Coast anymore," George told the dispatcher. "I had an incident down there with a conductor. I know it's going to be rough, and I'm not going back down there."
George proposed switching with another attendant who had always wanted the coveted all-reserve train to Tampa, St. Petersburg, but didn't have George's seniority. George was willing to take a less desirable route to avoid any more trouble.
"Nope, you can't do that," the dispatcher told him. "Look, I just told you I had an incident down there. I'm not going back down there, because I know what they're contemplating. I'm not going back."
"Well, I don't know what to tell you. You can't change."
George decided to call the other attendant himself.
"Look, you've been raving you want to run to St. Petersburg. I tell you what, when we come out Saturday, you sit up in my car in the West Coast, and I'll sit up in your car going to Miami. We'll just switch. You can go to St. Pete, and I'll take your run to Miami."
The attendant took George's old route, was happy to take it, and when George's stand-in got to Tampa, a group of white men met him at the train.
"Yeah, which one of you boys is that nigger boy called Starling? You George Starling?"
"No, sir. I ain't no George Starling."
"Well, by God, where is he?"
"Well, he's not on here."
"Well, by God, we gonna find him. He done got Captain Willis put in the street for 60 days, and we gonna teach him a lesson."
When the car attendant who traded routes with George got back from that first run to Tampa, he went to George and told him what had happened.
"Boy," he said, "I don't know what you did down there, but they mad with you down there. Don't you go back down there."
"Why, you think I switched with you?" George asked.
"You tell them don't worry. I'm not coming back down there no time soon."
George didn't go back to Tampa for 5 years. New conductors and managers came in, and it was only then that George felt it safe to go back. Los Angeles, 1961, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. It was well into the night of March 20th, 1961, when the telephone rang at the Foster house on Victoria, and Robert took the call. A nearly hysterical voice was coming at him, and Robert tried to make out the facts tumbling out from the other end of the line. It was the wife of a man who had somehow stumbled and sliced his left hand on the edge of a glass table, severing an artery. The man was hemorrhaging and losing consciousness. The man would need to be seen right away. Robert would drop everything for any of his patients, and had done so countless times, to the detriment of his own family. But this injury got his attention more than most. It was a disoriented Ray Charles who was facing the loss of the use of his left hand, a disaster for the piano-playing singer, or, with all the bleeding he sustained, the loss of more than that. The circumstances of the fall were unclear and only made the situation more delicate. For several days, Ray had been under pressure to write a playbook of songs for a big tour coming up. He had put in long hours dictating the music in his head to a collaborator writing the songs down on paper. He had been up most of the previous night, had worked all day and into a second night. He was finding it hard to stay alert, and he was running out of time. He had turned to drugs before, and so now summoned his heroin dealer to help him get through the night, according to his biographer, Michael Lydon. After the dealer's last visit to Ray's house near Baldwin Hills, Ray went thrashing about alone in his den, knocking into walls and furniture, out of his mind. Ray would later say the episode had less to do with drugs than fatigue, although he was candid about his drug use. "I didn't see how the dope was hurting," he said in his 1978 autobiography, Brother Ray. "I don't mean I wasn't sick now and then in those years, 'cause I was. I'd hit a dry period and go through the same convulsions as any other junkie." As for the events leading up to that night, he said, "I'm sure that sometime during that day, like all days, I had my little fix, and maybe it was stronger than usual." That night, as he remembered it, he collapsed from exhaustion, and somehow, in my state of unconsciousness, I slammed my hand against a glass tabletop and sliced it to ribbons. His hand went numb. He was so high, exhausted, or just out of it, the injury didn't register with him. And he just lay there, bleeding like a hog. It was around that time that his son Ray Jr. ventured into the den. Little Ray was 6 years old and wanted to say goodnight to his father. The boy opened the door to his father's den and found him with his shirt covered in blood and blood on the walls. Ray's riding partner and his drummer rushed in to help him. They wrapped his hand in beach towels, soaking up 2 quarts worth of blood, and tried to get him walking to keep him from losing consciousness. They chose not to call an ambulance under the circumstances. His wife Della B., then 8 months pregnant, instead called Robert, who told them to meet him at his clinic at once. Ray arrived at Robert's office on West Jefferson Avenue, bleeding so heavily that he went into convulsions. Robert quickly sewed the wound and admitted Ray into the hospital, where Ray required a transfusion of 4 pints of blood. There, Robert examined Ray more closely and discovered that Ray had not only sliced an artery, but severed a tendon as well. Robert would have to perform emergency surgery to reconnect the tendon if Ray was to regain use of his hand. After the surgery, Robert told Ray he was not to use the hand for 6 weeks. "Naturally, I refused," Ray said years later. His big tour was starting the next week, so he told Robert he would just play with one hand. A publicist had already devised an explanation for the public. They would say he had slipped in the bathtub. Robert could not have been pleased with Ray's insistence, but knew him well enough not to be surprised. With Ray determined to go on tour against doctor's orders, Robert insisted on going along with him to attend to the wound should anything happen to it, which naturally it did. Robert put a cast on the hand to protect it, but that only seemed to attract attention and endanger it more. "Everyone I met couldn't resist touching it or shaking it," Ray recalled. "The hand did get infected, but Bob was there to keep me straight." The tour was a dream of Ray's from back when he had gotten his start in those Jim Crow towns in Florida, where he could just see himself leading a big band like Duke Ellington's, with trombones, trumpets, saxophones, guitars, him on piano, of course, and the Raylettes, his doo-wopping backup singers in their form-fitting sequins and stilettos. Robert traveled with them to St. Louis, checking on his most famous patient's most precious instrument, and loving his front-row seat to smoke-filled celebrity. The tour continued on to Detroit, where Ray struck up his orchestra, and somebody decided to bring a blind teenager onto the stage. It was said that the teenager had been signed up by a new outfit called Motown, and could sing and play the harmonica. It was Stevie Wonder, Little Stevie as he was known back then, who, not surprisingly, idolized Ray Charles, and got the chance to play a few songs with him that spring night in Detroit. Ray's hard-driving life of drugs and women was beginning to catch up with him. He would end up arrested for drug possession in Boston, and would end up fathering a total of 12 children, only 3 of them by his wife Della B., who divorced him in 1977. But it occurred to him as he was writing his biography that he did not want to leave the wrong impression about his physician, a man he described as one of the dearest people I've ever known. He said, "I must say something about Bob, though, before anyone gets the wrong idea. Although he was my personal friend, and although he traveled with me for about 10 days during the time my hand was in the cast, I never let him do anything illegal for me. I liked him too well for that. If you really love a person, you won't get him involved in something which might hurt him." The hand began to heal, and after a week and a half on the road, Robert felt it safe to return to Los Angeles and to his practice. "He sewed up my hand so smoothly that you can barely detect the cuts today," Ray said years later. "He's the man who got me through the crisis with my hand, and for a piano player, that's some serious business." It was time for Robert to leave the tour for another reason, Not only did he have a life and practice back in Los Angeles, he had another patient to attend to. Ray's wife, Della B., was expecting her third child and wanted Robert to deliver her baby. She had had a difficult delivery with her first son before she had heard of Robert Foster and had now come to rely on him. The baby was born in May of 1961. It was a boy. After all that had happened in the preceding month and the time spent tending them before that, the couple decided to name the new baby Robert. The North, 1915 to 1975. From the very beginning, scholars would debate the effects of the migration, whether it was a success or a failure, whether the people who left had done better by leaving or would have been better off staying, whether the poorest among them merely imported the disorganized family systems inherited from slavery and carried into sharecropping, or whether the anonymous, overpacked cities merely brought out the worst in the weaker souls. Usually these were macroeconomic, sociological questions as to the effect of the North or South on the people who left or stayed. But back when the migration first began, the venerable Chicago Commission on Race Relations, convened after World War I, chose to ask the migrants themselves about their perceptions of how they were faring in the North. These were a few of their responses. Do you feel greater freedom and independence in Chicago? In what ways? Yes, feel free to do anything I please, not dictated to by white people. Yes, can vote, no lynching, no fear of mobs, can express my opinion and defend myself. Yes, feel more like a man, same as slavery in a way at home. I don't have to give up the sidewalk here for white people. Sure, feel more freedom. Was not counted in the South. Colored people allowed no freedom at all in the South. What were your first impressions of Chicago? When I got here and got on the streetcar and saw colored people sitting by white people all over the car, I just held my breath, for I thought any minute they would start something. Then I saw nobody noticed it, and I just thought this was a real nice place for colored people. Was completely lost. Friend was to meet me, but didn't, and I was afraid to ask anyone where to go. Finally, my friend came. Was afraid to sleep first night, so much noise. Thought the cars would finally stop running so I could rest. Always liked Chicago, even the name, before I came. Didn't like it. Lonesome, until I went out. Liked Chicago from the first visit made 2 years ago. Was not satisfied until I was able to get back. In what respects is life harder or easier here than in the South? Easier. You can make more money and it means more to you. Find it easier to live because I have more to live on. Earn more money. The strain is not so great, wondering from day to day how to make a little money do. Harder because of increased cost of living. What do you like about the North? Freedom and opportunity to acquire something. Freedom allowed in every way. Freedom of speech, right to live and work as others, higher pay for labor. Freedom, privileges, treatment of whites, ability to live in peace, not held down. Freedom of speech and action, can live without fear, no Jim Crow. The schools for the children, the better wages, and the privileges for colored people. The people, the freedom and liberty colored people enjoy here that they never before experienced. What difficulties do you think a person from the South meets in coming to Chicago? Getting accustomed to cold weather and flats. Rooming and closeness of the houses. Growing accustomed to being treated like people. Getting used to the ways of the people, not speaking or being friendly. Colder weather, hard on people from the South. I know of no difficulties. Are you advising friends to come to Chicago? Yes, people down there don't really believe the things we write back. I didn't believe myself until I got here. No, I am not going to encourage them to come, for they might not make it,
then I would be blamed. Wish all the colored folks would come up here where you ain't afraid to breathe.